Welcome to Life Quest Liberty, live in-depth conversations with today's top writers, editors, and spiritual leaders concerning religious freedom around the world. On today's broadcast, we'll examine local and international factors that may be impacting your right to worship and obey God as your conscience dictates. I'm your Life Quest Liberty host, Charles Mills. We speak often of some of the religious liberty hotspots in this world. Lincoln Steed, editor of Liberty Magazine, is with us to discuss the latest. It's in a country hidden from view by some very tall mountains and generations of social obscurity. Lincoln, we've got our passports and immunizations, and we've been through security. Where are you taking us today?
Well, it's a country that probably no one's heard about, Bhutan.
Bhutan, okay.
Somebody who I won't name, when I mentioned that, they thought we were going to a tropical island.
That's right.
Isn't there a Bhutan?
Yes, there is.
Where one of the World War II battles was fought.
Absolutely.
But Bhutan, I haven't been there. I've been very close by, and we'll talk a little later about there. I've been to Nepal, the top of India, there, the roof of the world, the Himalayas. And there's a tiny little kingdom called Bhutan near Nepal and Tibet. And you would think that everything's perfect there. We've got an article on this, and the article evokes Shangri-La. You know, Shangri-La is from the imagination of an author. James Hilton wrote a novel called Shangri-La, where there's a place of eternal youth and sort of heaven on earth. There probably is no such place, but many people do imagine the Himalayas with the little prayer wheels and the Tibetan monks, and if it's Tibet, but they have the similar monks in that whole area.
Yeah.
And just a sort of an idyllic surrounding. And Bhutan, if you do know about it, has a bit of that image. It's gotten very good press of late, but as we can share here for the next few minutes, not all great in paradise. Since I am in the mood to tell stories, though, I'll tell a story that might be hard to communicate. I like British comedy. And I especially like a comedy show called The Goon Show, dates from the 1950s, which I barely date from, but I've discovered it later in life. And Peter Sellers, who some people might remember, and a singer, Harry Secombe, were the actors on it. It was a radio program. So, again, you imagine most of it in your mind. And they did a takeoff on the book Shangri-La. And for them, it was Shangri-La. And it started off with Harry Secombe painting a word picture of this place. And he says, you know, and I came through the gap in the mountains, and there were the little prayer flags fluttering in the breeze. There were the little villages. And, you know, he says it idyllic. The music stops, and then he yells out, more, more, more. Got carried away with his own narration. But as I said, Shangri-La, or Bhutan, as we call it today, is not quite as idyllic as that. I saw a newsreel recently of some wonderful social innovations in that small country that's ruled by a king. Probably he's a chieftain, but he's been denominated a king. King Jigme Singye Wangchuck. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of money there, and he's a king that's fairly involved with the lives of his citizens. And the show that I saw, you know, you'd think it's very progressive. But as you read the article that we have in Liberty, and as I'm sharing it, things are not quite what they seem, because most of the population in Bhutan are Buddhist. Mm-hmm. There's the little prayer wheels and the flags and the monks and all the rest. And Buddhism itself is an interesting religion, which we can't go into too deeply, but Buddhism at root is really just a philosophy. The Buddha was a ruler in India, or a part of India, who was troubled by the inequalities of life and, you know, grander issues, and troubled that he was wealthy and others were so poor. And he basically threw over his high estate and became an itinerant philosopher and developed a whole worldview about how you lose yourself and meditate and think on higher values. And it wasn't really till many, many hundreds of years later that he, in essence, became deified. And even today, the Buddhist monks, I remember talking to a Buddhist monk in Thailand, and he agreed very freely that the Buddha was just a human being that had some good philosophies. But the average person, he says, they like to worship and treat it as a spiritual, you know, non-human thing. Mm-hmm. But most of them in Bhutan are Buddhist. But at one stage, 20% of the population were also Hindu, which is a recipe for problems in many countries to have split religions. Religions tend to compete and prejudicial statements said and so on. But what added a little extra pizzazz to the dynamic in Bhutan is that many of these Hindus had come from India or Nepal. So there was a sense of otherness.
Yes.
And they also were mostly in the south of the country. Things were not great in paradise. And a few years ago, they deported a whole bunch of them, which I'm sure antagonized or created antagonisms in both populations.
Sure.
And then most recently, only within the last decade, they started deporting more of them. Many, many thousands of them, tens of thousands of them. And they're in camps across the border, and many of them have gone to Western countries. 35,000 to the United States, and 2,500 in Canada, and another 10,000 due to go to Canada. So, you know, this is a major exodus for a little country that only has a few million people, all about religion. And it's not just that they're being deported. If that was the case, that would be sad, something that the international community could object to, because these people, most of them have lived there for generations. Mm. Some of them trace their family history back 400 years, which, you know, in the Middle East, events in the 50s and 60s define people's identity. But in reality, in most parts of the world, when you're talking multiple generations in a place, it's not a question you're a foreigner from somewhere else. You know, here in the United States, we'd all be in trouble.
Yes.
We've all come from somewhere else except the few Indians that are left from the Indian Wars days. So, you know, these are people that have lived there forever, but the government is saying that they are recent immigrants. The government is saying that they all came when a dam was built about 20 years ago, but that couldn't be so because only a very few were brought in then, and we're dealing with as many as 20% of the population. Mm-hmm. Oh, by the way, I forgot the most interesting thing that the readers will be interested in this. The king in 1972 came up with an interesting governmental concept. Here in the United States, we talk about the gross national product, mm-hmm. which we've pretty much spent for perpetuity. but that's another question.
Yes.
Not religious liberty, but it's financial liberty. But in Bhutan, the king came up with the concept of gross national happiness.
Oh, well, that's nice.
Yeah, which is a Buddhist-inspired concept or an alternative to gross national product. But that's very touchy-feely. Gross national happiness. But, you know, we've got debt problems and they have gross national happiness problems. Because this issue with the Hindu minority doesn't really comport with gross national happiness.
No, it does not.
And it's more than deporting those people so that those left behind are happy. Many of them, and they're telling stories as they come out, and our author of this article interviewed any number of them in Canada. There's quite a community there, as I've said before. And the tortures that they have gone through have been quite interesting, starting with things that are abusive religious behaviors, mm-hmm. the types of things that they've had to put up with in the schools, mm-hmm. the children are forced to eat beef, mm-hmm. which might sound pretty good out in the plain states of the U.S. here or in McDonald's territory, but for Hindus, yes. that's that's anathema.
Yeah.
So it's been abusive lifestyle-wise, but it's gotten worse because many of them, if they speak out at all about the mistreatment of their minority, mm-hmm. they are imprisoned and tortured regularly. And to me, it's very reminiscent of the tortures that I've heard from different people that were imprisoned. For example, in Sri Lanka, I remember a Seventh-day Adventist pastor was imprisoned there, and he said almost every day they would hang him up by his feet and beat him with rods on the soles of his feet to cripple him but not to leave any mark. Same stories are coming out of Bhutan, and that's a very sophisticated form of torture. That's not just being hauled into the police station and roughed up and your head banged against the wall, which happens far too often around the world. No, this is a calculated way to break people down. And these sort of things are happening a lot in Bhutan. And one of the fellows that was tortured, he said his eyes were damaged by the torture. Of course, that's hitting them so much on the head that it impairs their vision.
Sure.
Of course, the hitting on the feet. Girls have been raped by the police and soldiers. And we tend to think in the West of rape as a crime of passion or just a brutality that's inflicted on someone. But that's not usually the case in this sort of semi-civil war. Usually it's a matter of policy to break down the self-respect of your opponents and also to break down their ethnic difference by mixing the blood, creating offspring that really, in the eyes of the perpetrators of the rape, is spreading their seed and their kind into this other. It's a damnable behavior, obviously. So, you know, I just wanted to bring before our listeners the concern. It's, you know, we hear a lot about Islam that persecutes vigorously its own minorities and, of course, in many places around the world is reacting violently against the West and Christianity. We do hear of persecution of Christians, but we don't hear much about this sort of thing between Buddhists and Hindus, for example, in a little distant corner of the world that you think would be calm and kind.
In a letter to the Reverend Samuel Miller, Thomas Jefferson wrote, "Everyone must act according to the dictates of his own reason, and mine tells me that civil powers alone have been given to the President of the United States, and no authority to direct the religious exercises of his constituents." Jefferson understood the importance of keeping church and state separate. A message from your friends at www.libertymagazine.org.
We're talking with Lincoln Steed, editor of Liberty Magazine. Today our topic is, it's a tough one because we are talking about the persecution of people based solely on the fact that they don't believe the way that other people believe. I mean, they can look the same. They can look identical.
Yeah, they're not necessarily very ethnically different.
Yes, their belief system is different. And it always comes back to me, and I'm always frustrated with this, and you always help me, so I want you to do it today, too. Why on earth, how is it possible that people whose religion teaches peace and tactfulness and fellow man loving, how is it possible that those types of individuals and those types of religion can turn so violent? And, of course, I have to put my own religion, Christian, in that because we have a history of being just like that with people who don't believe the way we believe. How is that possible? Explain it to me.
Well, I think there's two main reasons. First of all, when you're dealing with a religion, this is obviously important because you're dealing with your view of the entire universe.
Mm-hmm.
You have identified either the God that is preeminent or the spiritual principle that explains everything.
Mm-hmm.
Then when you look at another faith, this is not only just competition, it may actually represent the total antithesis to good and godhood. You're dealing with something that's pernicious and evil and needs to be attacked and wiped out. I think that largely explains the antagonism between major faiths.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the underlying explanation, which you can move to any situation, is human beings tend that way. And from my Bible, I get the idea. It says the man's thoughts of man's heart are evil continually.
Yes.
We're corrupted in our inner spirit. We've lost inherently a true understanding of goodness and kindness and of God-likeness. And so left to our own devices, even with religion not fully integrated into our thinking, we can be very violent. I think it's just a natural human inclination. Doesn't make it right, but it naturally occurs.
And it seems to me that there is a disconnect then between the individual and his belief or her belief. You cannot be the kind of person that these people are being, that we have been in the past, and still truly believe the faith that is, they say, is driving these acts.
Well, it's not a disconnect, but it's an inbuilt contradiction that people seldom see. We faced with that with these Islamic extremists. Yes. The Quran just constantly says, you know, Allah is merciful, peace be upon him, and so on. But once in that holy book, it identifies a certain viewpoint or a certain behavior as from the devil or to be wiped out. They take their marching orders from that and execute it as told. But underneath that, it's a contradiction. It's even a contradiction in the word. You know, it says, kill the infidel without mercy and all the rest because they've denied Allah. May his name be prayed, Allah the most merciful.
Yes.
And I'm picking on the Quran. You can do a bit of the same thing in the Old Testament if you're not careful, if you don't read the context clearly. So that's where people sort of obey one part of the dictate and close their mind off to the inconsistency. But yes, you're right. Any religion that claims to elevate spirituality and the higher moral values of someone and bring in guidelines for good living really should be totally incompatible with violent acts and not just discrimination, but hatred and violence and so on against other people.
So when we are tolerant, when we are kind, when we allow religious liberty to happen around us, I hear you saying that in many cases we're actually going against ourselves. We're going against our inclination, our evil selves. We have to overcome self to do what you say in Liberty Magazine.
Spiritually, we have to overcome self. Civilly, we have to hold self in abeyance to a shared principle. Mm-hmm. And that's the genius in the United States of the First Amendment and the Declaration of Independence. You know, these things that are self-evident, we're only self-evident to a few people.
That's
They're
true.
Not always self-evident. But we've compacted together to honor and respect and to protect those things, even if the majority don't agree. That's what presently in the United States, I think, is being forgotten. Majoritarianism will eventually restrict the minority, particularly on matters of religion. So it's not what most people think. It's that most people have to agree to allow what they think is not right, or to put themselves, as, you know, the old thing, put yourselves in someone else's shoes, because someone else may think what you believe is not right. You would want them to allow that, so you allow them what you would want for yourself.
Okay, I'm
golden rule, I guess.
Yeah, I'm getting an idea here. In other words, if we got off the airplane in Bhutan and Lincoln Steed walked into the middle of whatever town they have there, and he stood up and you wanted to deliver this message in a short paragraph, what would you say? Let's say the king was sitting there in front of you as well. What would you say to these people to identify the problem and to help them see the solution?
Well, it's hard to know. I mean, they would not react well. But I do think as far as Bhutan goes, we need to remind them that they're part of a world community. Mm-hmm. And what might seem fine to them in their closed system is a great social injustice, and that the world does not accept this. That just because the majority of their population, and it's said in this article that on a personal level, there's not necessarily such huge antagonism and people are not overly troubled, but a governmental policy is behind this and great injustice and violence is being served on a minority. And so the ruler, the king, needs to be made aware that you know, it's not all sweetness and light, that he needs to obey a higher law, if not the moral one, then an international understanding of what's right and proper needs to be maybe imposed is the wrong word, but morally projected upon him and an expectation created.
And that is exactly what we need to do in our little communities here in this country. We need to recognize that there is a much larger family in which we live, that we are brothers and sisters of not just the person that is in our family tree, but in the orchard and in the land surrounding the orchard, that our family tree and the roots of our family stretch all around the world. That's an important lesson, Lincoln.
I said at the beginning I'd make a comment about being in Nepal.
Yes.
A few years ago now, but that was a great experience for me. I'll never forget that as long as I live. We flew from Hong Kong several hours. I think it was about 4 hours, but it was a long flight on a modern Royal Nepal 757, across Bangladesh. I saw the flooded fields there. And then as we saw the Himalayas come into view, it became more surreal because we were at a cruising altitude, I think around 30,000. but it seemed almost at our level, certainly poking way up above the clouds. Here were the Mount Everest and these other mountains. It was uncanny. You're not used to at cruising altitude to be bumping shoulders with mountains. The scale of things up there is just phenomenal. And then we came down through the clouds and between the mountains to land at Kathmandu. I was sitting next to a Royal Nepal pilot, and he leaned to me and he says, "The pilots are very afraid to land in Kathmandu."
I don't blame them.
But we threaded the needle and we landed, and it was literally another world. Not necessarily Shangri-La, because there is incredible poverty there, just not the filth and overcrowding that you might find more south in parts of India. But not wealthy, not very technologically advanced. A lot of disease. We went up to a hospital run by the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and the parade of misery that was moving toward the hospital was something else. And I will never forget also, this is not religious liberty, but it's a concern for other people that should go with us fighting for their right to believe whatever. But out back of the hospital, there were wooden forms made out of dowels in pieces of flat wood, and they had surgical gloves on the wooden forms drying in the sun. Usually they're disposable. Yes. They were using them over and over again. And we looked through the hospital, which, of course, didn't smell too great, and saw a young girl dying of pneumonia. I asked the question. I said, you know, what can be done? And I said, well, if she had oxygen, she'd be fine, but we have no oxygen. And it meant a drive down to the town to buy oxygen, and was not feasible, so that she died that night. Now, these are desperate places, and Shangri-La doesn't really exist, and even, of course, with religious tolerance, it still would be a difficult place. But religion does function, I believe, in a very real way to help people accommodate to their situation. They can bear more if they see a cosmic meaning to it all, and if there's a hope beyond this world. So when we allow religious persecution, we're striking at more than just living standards, which might be desperate. We're striking at the very will to live and the reason for living
reason
for people.
For living, yes.
Yeah. One thing I remember in Kathmandu that's stuck in my mind, we went through some of the museums and the Hindu temples and so on. There's more Hinduism, as I remember, in Kathmandu. And at one stage, we were going through this temple with some other tourists. It wasn't really a tour, but there were other tourists that were trailing along. And I heard one of these Indians say to his friend, he said, because they were going through a gate, and it was into a temple area, and he said, "I should go through before you." He says, "I am of a higher caste than you."
Oh, okay.
These are two friends, but he put him down in a couple of other words that were a little harsher than that. Now, that is a very bad thing that develops out of Hinduism. Other religions have their problems. But Hinduism has enshrined a view of hierarchy in life, like some people clean garbage pits and other people do office work. I mean, that's always the case in every country, but in Hinduism, that's fate, that's what the gods determined to you.
That's your birthright.
And worse, you can't change. If you change, you're told, well, you're of a lower caste. Your caste is to do whatever. So we do have a phenomenon in that part of the world of some people becoming Christians or perhaps even other religions to escape the caste constraint. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work that easily, but it's at least a beginning. But there's a case of a religion actually holding people down, perpetrating a very bad economic situation. An interesting part of the world that most people know about only because of Mount Everest the romanticized mountaineers and the oxygen tanks and the unnamed, usually, Sherpas that do most of the work to get them up. I sometimes wonder why there's so much made of these Western mountaineering tourists, because they have to hire hundreds and hundreds of Sherpas to get them up the mountain. At every stage, they carry all the stuff, usually without oxygen. And so they're the real heroes of it and could climb it. Well, they wouldn't climb to the summit themselves. They had no reason to, but they're the ones that are really capable of climbing to those points. Now, I should mention in passing, we have a couple of minutes, don't we?
Yes.
When I went to Nepal, I wrote a book and was there to interview an American doctor who was working at the hospital there. He'd had a wild and woolly life as an outdoorsman. He was a doctor, but he and his wife used to go on adventures, and she was killed on one adventure, and he just spun out of control, pretty much, as he said, became a ghost, having adventures and roaming the world, but like an empty shell. And it wasn't until he discovered the hospital there on a hiking trip. He was climbing Annapurna, got into a talk with some fellow doctors, and they said, you know, you say life's meaningless and medicine doesn't make much sense. It's all for money. They said, why don't you stay here and be a missionary doctor? And he says, well, he says, there's, you know, no way I could do it. And they looked on the wall of the little restaurant they were in, and there was a sign that says, Christian Hospital needs doctors and medical staff. And so he ripped that down from the wall and walked up there, that same hill where I saw the cavalcade of sickness. And he said, I'm here to help. And he was a bearded guy, shabby clothes and all the rest. And they took him in and offered him a position. And for a couple of years, he worked there, became a Christian, found a nurse. Every doctor should find his nurse.
Absolutely.
And turned his life around and gained a real spiritual vision for what he was doing. So to me, visiting that area was very inspiring. But at the same time, a lot of poverty, a lot of sickness, and as we've seen in this discussion of Bhutan, a lot of inequality and as other places, religious persecution writ large to divide communities and to just physically abuse a whole percentage of a population that really is, no, as you said, no different from their fellows, right, except for the religion.
And you know that story you just said about that doctor who found a reason to live, he found that by doing what we all need to do. We don't shirk our fellow man. We don't ignore or persecute or hurt or ostracize our fellow man. We serve our fellow man. And in serving the people who are not like us, this man found his salvation, and we can find it too. Am I on the right track, Lincoln?
Absolutely. Mm. You know, there's that poem by John Donne. He says, ask not for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. Mm. And the bell he was talking about was someone else's death,
yes,
or the destiny of another person. We're all tied up to each other. Mm. Human societies, of course, exist on that concept of people interrelated, and someone, you know, makes a horseshoe, someone else makes the saddle,
yes,
and someone else tills the land. We are connected, and religion shouldn't disconnect it. It can be different in each person's mind, but we can all share a commitment to spirituality and to cooperation and to the higher values that I think, even though there are right and wrong religions, but I think all religions emphasize higher moral values of human behavior.
Mm. Very, very good. Thank you, Lincoln Steed, for being with us today.
Always a pleasure.
And listener, I hope that you've enjoyed this program as much as I have. And until next time, this is Charles Mills, along with Lincoln Steed, editor of Liberty Magazine, inviting you to rest in the freedom of God's love. Goodbye, everyone.
You've been listening to Life Quest Liberty. To further explore the issues discussed on today's program, visit www.libertymagazine.org. Join us again next week at this same time as we examine more of the threats and challenges facing your religious freedom. May God keep the flames of religious freedom burning in your heart today.